Jim, whom we'd never met, identified himself at a Washington, D.C. airport by holding up a copy of our book, Marriage Takes More Than Love. As we settled in his car, we went out to get his wife in a suburb. And again, getting back into the car to go to a conference center, his wife turned to us in the back seat and said, "How'd y'all meet?" Well, that's one of our very, very favorite questions, not only to be asked, but to ask other people. Fortunately, this time, Jack decided on the short version, and he said, "We met in college." This lady looked startled, flushed, stammered, and then said, "How did Jim find you at the airport?" And I thought, thank you, Lord, that Jack used the short version. Communication is difficult. Sometimes we are as confused as the people in Washington, D.C. airport who heard this announcement over the loudspeaker. Will all those Piedmont passengers who have not done so, please do so immediately. Communication is difficult. And true communication involves more than speaking. It involves more than listening. And it involves more than a combination of the two. Communication, as we want to define it this morning, is actually a meeting of meaning. When my meaning meets your understanding across the bridge of words, body postures, tone of voice, all these various ways of communicating, then we can say we have truly communicated. But even as I give you that definition, at least two groups of you here heard it differently. You objective people heard it, yes, when my factual meaning gets across to the other person's mind, then we really have communicated. You subjective people heard it, yes, when the meaning of the way I'm feeling about a matter is really understood, then we have communicated. Now, friends, this difference affects the communication process in ways that I can't even begin to tell you. Let me illustrate it this way. Let's say there are two people, and we're going to make this one the man, not that it always is, but just because Jack is this. And we have a subjective feeling person, which happens to be me. And you haven't really talked for a few weeks, not really in depth. And so you decide that you're going to take 3 hours, you're going to go out for dinner, and you're really going to communicate. And so you spend an hour getting caught up on what's happening with the kids and your work and your schedules and your friends. Now, at the end of the first hour, this objective person's cup, communication cup, is already 50% full. This subjective feeling person's cup is about 5% full. And so you spend another hour talking about a problem that the man's having with a client and what you want to do on next year's vacation and how you're doing with your financial planning. Now his cup, at the end of the second hour, you know, it's already 85% full. And her cup, maybe 15. So the next hour, you start talking about what the couples that are struggling with in your Bible study and some difficult things that are going on in the kids' lives right now. Starting to talk about feelings. And so at the end of the 3 hours, his cup is almost full. Her cup is, maybe 45%. And you leave the restaurant, and the husband says, what a fantastic time of in-depth communication we've had. And she's thinking, we've only just begun. And he's saying, we'll have to do this next month. And she's thinking, what about tomorrow? Now, friends, what's happened here? Now, for you subjective people, I don't have to tell you what's happened. But for you objective people, let me explain. See, in order for this kind of person to really feel that their communication cup is full, that they've really been heard, that you've explored things of the heart, you have got, she has got to talk about feelings. In order for her cup to be filled to the top, you've got to get below the factual stuff and get into what's going on in heart-to-heart communication. Now, I realize that's very, very difficult for a factual person. And Jack and I have struggled with this through the years. But I cannot tell you how grateful I am that Jack has learned to not only express his feelings to me, but to listen to mine. It has meant everything in our communication. Now, if you objective people want a question to ask to really get down to where we subjective people are living, you could ask a question like, tell me on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being high, how are you feeling right now in your relationship with the Lord? How are you feeling right now in your relationship with as a mom, as a daughter, as a wife, as a friend? You can go right on down the scale. And then if you really want to put icing on the cake, just take one of those areas and explore your own feelings about that with her. Yes, it takes practice. Yes, it takes work. That's what we're talking about. Learning to do that. Someone has said you can't know anyone unless you communicate with them. You can't love anything you don't know. Therefore, the depth of love existing between a husband and a wife will largely depend upon the amount and depth of their communication. We're talking about depth here. Now, obviously, this is not an easy thing to do. Communication is very complex. In fact, we find that there are basically six messages involved in the communication process. You don't need to write this down. This just is an illustration here. But these six things, messages, are involved in the communication process. What you mean to say, what you actually say, what the other person hears, what the other person thinks he hears, what the other person says about what you said, and what you think the other person said about what you said. See why it gets complicated? Now let me illustrate that with just looking at the moon. What did I mean to say? Well, I meant to say that that moon is so beautiful, it's making me feel romantic. What I actually said was, isn't that a gorgeous moon? What Jack could have heard was, oh yeah, the moon's pretty bright there. What he thinks he hears is, she thinks it'd be a nice night to take a walk. So what he says about what I said was, yeah, that's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by. And what I think he says about what I said is, I don't feel romantic. See how in two sentences you can totally bypass each other? And my friends, the awful thing about it is that we do this all the time. We bypass each other. And we haven't a clue as to what the other person is really saying. So there are some commitments in the communication process. And one of the commitments that we need to do is a commitment to speak clearly. And in order to speak clearly, we need to start decoding each other's messages. Now, I am very adept at coding messages because I sneak up on things. I told you that. But even Jack, in his very factual way of speaking, can speak in coded messages. For instance, Jack will come in and say, what time is dinner? Now, wouldn't you think that was a very simple, one-level statement? And most of you women would think, well, Jack's hungry. He wants dinner. See, I know better when Jack says, what time is dinner? He could be actually asking, do I have time to exercise before dinner? If I don't know that, I'm hurrying up dinner and he wants it delayed. It happens All the time, really. We were going down the street with a couple. We'd spent the day with them. And all of a sudden, this girl said, it's 5 o'clock. I thought, well, now, isn't that interesting? We all had watches. We all knew it was 5 o'clock. Well, we had just been talking about this. So I kind of laughed and I said, okay, Jeannie, what are you really saying? Well, what Jeannie was really saying was, do I have time to go home and check on the children before we go out for dinner? She probably would have gone the whole evening frustrated if I hadn't have asked. Because somehow we don't want to, I don't know if it's our pride or what, we don't want to really come out and say that. And so we speak in coded messages. So number one commitment is to learn as much as possible to speak clearly. In order to do that, we have constantly got to go through the process of asking the other questions. What do you mean? What are you really saying? This is how I'm understanding what you're saying. Now, granted, friends, there are people who are so threatened by a what do you mean question that they get angry when you ask it. And they'll say, well, you shouldn't know what I mean. Now, if you're one of those people, I would pray for you, and I hope you pray for yourself, that God would help you mature beyond that. Because we've got to get to the place where we can be open and honest and vulnerable with one another and learn to handle what do you mean kind of questions. But my friend, if you're living with a person who can't handle a what do you mean question, then what you have got to work very hard at is learning how to restate what you think that person is saying without asking a question. Instead of saying, what do you mean? You'll have to say, you know, I'm getting the feeling that probably something very disturbing happened to you at work today. Or I'll bet you meant that you don't want to go out tonight. And you're making a statement rather than asking a question. So, first of all, it is a commitment to speak clearly. Secondly, there is a commitment to be a revealer of what's going on in your life. A revealer of your feelings. Now, I know that with you objective people, this is a number one assignment for you. It's very difficult for you, some of you, to get in touch with your feelings. It's also very difficult for you to express your feelings after you do get in touch with them because you are the strong silent type, and there's nothing wrong with the strong silent type. You could be an introvert. Jack is all those. But my friends, it can be learned. And I read about one fellow who was definitely the concealer person. You know, some of us are revealers and some of us are concealers. I tend to be the revealer. It's not so hard for me to tell you what's going on in my life. Jack tends to be the concealer. But I read about one fellow who was a concealer. And first of all, he recognized that his silence was selfishness. And that it did not show his wife, who longed for deeper communication, real love. He confessed that selfishness to God as sin. I thought that was an interesting thing to do. And then he realized that love was not a feeling, but a decision. And that is so true. Hopefully love often is a feeling, but is always a decision. And then he made the decision that by God's grace, he was going to learn to be a communicator, no matter what it cost. Now, Jack, I don't think, went through those steps. But somewhere along the line, he did commit himself to learning because he knew I desperately needed to have him share his feelings with me and me to be able to share my feelings with him. And for him to really listen to them. Ephesians 4:15 is kind of the sum total of scripture, I think, as far as the communication process. And it talks about not being immature children. But then this little phrase, but speaking the truth in love. We are to grow up in every way unto him who is the head, even Christ. Oh, my friends, if we could just filter all of our communication through that one little phrase, we'd be way ahead. Speaking the truth, we do have to deal with truth, don't we? And I talk to many wives who are afraid to ever express a negative to their husbands, and so they're hiding 90% of who they are. And they're not obeying this command to speak the truth in love. That's to wives, just like it is to husbands. But you're to speak the truth in love. Not just the truth, but in love. You're to marry those. And the Old Testament puts it this way in Proverbs 3:3-6 in the Living Bible. Tremendous passage just to memorize. It says, never forget to be truthful and kind. Hold these virtues tightly. Write them deep within your heart. If you want favor with both God and man, and a reputation for good judgment and common sense, then trust the Lord completely. Don't ever trust yourself. In everything you do, put God first, and He will direct you and crown your efforts with success, including this one, to speak the truth in love. So there's a commitment to speak clearly. There's a commitment to be a revealer of what's going on inside of you. And there's a commitment of time in which to do this. My friends, if it is true, and Jack and I believe it is, that your number one priority apart from God Himself is your spouse, your marriage. That's your number two priority. After God, it's your number one priority. Then how can we really say we're too busy to give this relationship the time that God has commanded us to give it? But we're all so busy. Your wife may feel like the wife who had her, or the husband had his hand on the television knob. And he turned to his wife and he said, now, is there anything you want to say to me before football season starts? You know, some wives don't laugh at that. But we get too busy. And we let the best in our lives, each other in our relationship, be crowded out by the good in our lives. And that can be an awful lot of things. Jack and I had the privilege of sitting for a day under Dr. Norman Wright. And I think of Dr. Norman Wright as being Mr. Marriage Counselor. You know, he's written about 50 books, and he is full-time in giving marriage counseling, and he teaches marriage. And so it was a great opportunity just to sit under him for a day. And what he did was he allowed a few couples to watch him in premarital counseling. And he had gotten this engaged couple's permission to do this. And so as he's talking to this engaged couple, his question is, what makes you think you're going to make it? And this engaged couple said, well, we really love each other. And Mr. Wright said, yes. What else? Well, we're really committed to this. Yes. What else? Well, we really believe this is God's will. Yes. What else? He kept asking these. Well, they said everything you and I would have said. And he just kept saying, yes. What else? Until they didn't have anything else to say. And finally, he looked at them and he said, you know, 90% of the couples that I get in my office who are ready to be divorced have said exactly the same things you have. What makes you think you're going to make it? Well, all of us were squirming by this time. Then he turned to them and he said, let me tell you two things that may help your marriage to make it for the long haul. Of course, Jack and I were sitting on the edge of our chairs waiting to find out what these two things were. He said, number one, put into your budget time and money for some kind of a marriage retreat every year. Jack and I about fell off our chairs. We give them and we realize that in giving them, God has enabled us to be reminded. The marriage seminars that we give to help us more than anybody else, because we're constantly reminding ourselves of the things that we ought to be working on all the time. So we wanted to go hip hip hooray, but he says, if you can't go to a public one, that's okay, but take a weekend, get away and listen to some tapes and talk and read a book, But put into your budget time and money for some kind of a marriage retreat every year. Secondly, he said, date. Don't ever stop dating. And again, Jack and I wanted to go, hip, hip, hooray. We've been preaching this. We've been doing it for longer than 45 years. And a date to us is not date with kids, not a double date. It is Jack and me away someplace from the house, eyeball to eyeball, having fun and communicating. Don't save your heavies for the dates, by the way. Don't save quarrels or things you want to bring up that are difficult, because pretty soon you won't have dates. Dates are for fun, and dates are to communicate more deeply on things you never think to talk about before. Now, our goal is to have one a week. They've been everything from Denny's Saturday morning breakfast when we had a house full of people living with us, to popcorn take out in the back of the car when we haven't had any money to do anything else. It doesn't matter what they are, as long as it's the two of you enjoying one another. You find your romance, that helps your romance, it helps your communication, it helps everything. Well, what was he saying? He was saying, don't be too busy to make communication a priority, and we are often just plain too busy. It is probably the greatest hindrance in the communication process that we have in our generation, because our lives are so hectic, aren't they? We let so many things creep in that are overwhelming to us. So a commitment of time is absolutely essential. A commitment not to pull into oneself and therefore not to be vulnerable. It's a commitment to be vulnerable to one another, not to use silence as a tool against one another. 40% of troubled marriages are characterized by the silent husband. We pull in, we get mad, we stop talking, and we stop being vulnerable. The commitment to be vulnerable, it has to be a commitment for both of you. I'll just give you one funny little example of how you predetermine to be open and how you predetermine to keep asking questions that will be good questions to help the other person open up. A few years ago, we had a marriage seminar here. And I always get very intimidated here, you know, just standing up here in this place. I it's kind of awing, awesome for me. And when I get nervous, I start talking faster and faster. Remember, I told you that. And so I was very nervous, and I, at dinner Friday night, like last night, boy, I was just going a mile a minute, trying to make everybody feel at home and playing Little Miss Hostess. And I felt not fist on the thigh this time. It was a hand on my knee. And I felt a little hand patting my knee. And what Jack was saying was, honey, simmer down. I tried. Next day, speaking stimulates me anyway. Relating to people does too. So here I am, just really getting recharged. Several times, Jack leaned over to me and very sweetly said, honey, simmer down. I tried. That evening, we got up to our room here. I put my arms around him, and I said, honey, do you love me? Have you been married longer than 6 days? You know that if your wife asks you that, and that's not a real question, okay? And so Jack says, well, of course I love you. And I said, well, I need that assurance right now. And he said, well, for what reason? And I said, well, sometimes I guess I feel like you love me, but I'm not sure that you really like me. Now, what was I doing? I was really opening up, wasn't it? I was really sharing my feelings. At any point, Jack could have crushed me. But I want you to notice, I wrote this down after it happened because I realized we'd done something right here. But by this time, I'm feeling rather stupid, like I'd like to just be quiet and go to bed and say, forget the whole thing, because I realized it was stupid. But I was determined that Jack was going to understand. Jack was determined to keep asking me questions until he had really discovered what was going on. So he said, well, what has given you that impression? What have I done that would cause you to feel that way? And I said, well, several times today, you've told me to quiet down. And he said, but honey, you've been hyper all day. I was trying to help you. And I said, well, I think I know that, but when it's several times, I think you can't like me when I'm that way. And Jack said, but you need to accept the fact, that the reason is I want to help you. And I sighed and I said, my head does, but my heart doesn't always. And Jack said, honey, I love you and I like you. And with that, we went to bed. Now, notice in this conversation, every single thing that Jack said was a fact. And every response that I had was a feeling. We had to accept that about each other. There's no way that we're going to be any different. But Jack kept pursuing, and I kept trying to be as open and as vulnerable as I could. That's what I mean, friends, in just sharing feelings, being open, and being vulnerable. Two other commitments I want to talk about briefly, and then Jack's going to finish this. We have a commitment, friends, to learn to ask each other good questions, and everybody good questions as far as that's concerned. Questions are such a vital part of the communication process, and Jack and I find few couples even know how to ask them of other couples, let alone each other. Do you know how to ask questions that are more than yes or no questions? See, wives lots of times will wonder why their husbands don't communicate with them, and as their husband's coming in the door, they'll say, well, how was your day? And the husband will say, okay, and that's it. Wife, never ask your husband a question that can be answered with one word. They'll always give you one word. Did you know that? So we need to learn to ask questions such as, how did you feel? If you can ask a feeling question of your husband, the meeting went, or what happened in that planning session? Or was your day frustrating and why? But learn to ask good questions. Listen to other people's questions. Write them down. Think about it. And then, of course, you need to be aware of the fact of the kind of questions you ask to different types of people. Now, let me explain that. I am what the Myers-Briggs calls an intuitive person. My mind hops, skips, and jumps, and I come up with these harebrained ideas. Okay. Only according to the Myers-Briggs, which is probably the best temperament type indicator in the U.S. today, it's a tool, only 40% of us are intuitives. 60% of you out there are sensing type people. What they mean by that is that you take information in through your five senses, you process it very logically, and you come to a conclusion. And you want other people to think that way too. And we who ski jump in our thinking processes, it's very difficult for you sometimes to even listen to us because we're ski jumping. But anyway, for years, my friends, I ask my husband questions that are the intuitive type questions, the imagination type questions. And I would save these questions up. This is really terrible because I would save them up for our dates so we could have this wonderful conversation that I thought we were going to have. And so we go out for a date and I'd say, now, honey, if you had $1 million, how would you spend it? And Jack would think and he'd say, boy, I really don't know. Clunk. Now, sometimes he'd really try. Now, I'd say, sweetheart, if you were born as an animal, what kind of animal would you want to be? Now, you have all read in Bible studies these kind of questions different. Draw a picture of how you're feeling, you know. And I do believe that all the communication books are written by this N-type personality, where 60% of you out there are not this personality. All the time management books are probably written by the S-type people, the very logical sensing type people. So I would try again, because this would go clunk. And I would, next time, I would say something like, if you could rent a billboard for 2 months, what would you write on it? Some of you are wonderful questions. No. Some of you women are saying, oh, Carol, that's okay. That's fine. I don't mind. Well, one day, I began to realize what was happening with my questions that were falling as duds. When Jack had shoulder surgery a few years ago, and I was, as he's having shoulder surgery, I'm reading this article on what a wife should know as a widow. Terrible timing. But anyway, next time we were out for a date, I said, out of the clear blue sky, honey, who do you want to preach at your memorial service? And Jack says, I don't know, I haven't really thought about it. Clunk. Well, what songs do you want sung at your memorial service? He said, you know, I really don't care. I'm not going to be there. Well, I got home from that, and I thought, now, what did I do wrong? Because, you see, these questions I really wanted to know. But from Jack, they were coming right off the wall. He could not relate to that type questions. So what did I have to do? Well, I went to the Lord, and I got down on my knees, and I said, Lord, I really need wisdom for this. I really need wisdom to know how I can ask these questions that this time I really want to know. It isn't just a fun type question for me, that Jack will really hear. And so God gave me an idea. And the next time we were out for a date, I said to Jack, you know, sweetheart, one of us is going to die before the other. And if you're the one to die first, I'm going to be left in such a state of mind that I'm not going to know the answers to some questions that I really need to know. And he could understand that. And I said, who do you want to have preach at your memorial service? And he gave me three names. It suddenly became a practical question to him instead of an off the wall. Now, where are you in this? And what kind of questions are you asking that really can draw a person and get you going on some really good communication? The last commitment is a commitment to truly listen to one another. I sat across the table from a friend of mine, and as she wiped tears from her cheeks, I listened to her pour out a very sad story. She said, my marriage from day one has been hell. She told me a number of things, but then as we talked, I said, let me ask you a question. I said, if you could boil all the things that you've told me into one thing that would help you feel loved, because this was her problem, she did not feel loved, that would make you feel loved, what would it be? Without a moment's hesitation, she said, if only he would listen to me. I cannot tell you how much women especially feel that a very key factor to their feeling loved, to their being loved, is a man really listening. Listening from his heart, not just with his ears. Women need often feedback when we're being listened to. You know, with each other, we go, oh, really? Oh, no kidding. No, tell me about it. Is that right? With each other, we do that all the time. That's what we need from you. Now, I realize that the statistics tell us that women speak 25,000 words a day and men speak 10,000 words a day on the average. And I realize that with each other, you men often do not have that kind of verbal feedback with each other. But women need that verbal feedback. Sometimes I tell Jack, I say, honey, just turn on your uh-huh. Our daughter sometimes, if she doesn't feel her husband's listening to her, she'll, out of the clear blue sky, she'll say, and I said to the wall, wall? Well, that finally brings him to, you know, and then he gives her a little verbal feedback. But we need to be listened to this place where you'll say, hey, I'm not sure I quite understand that. Would you expand? I want to understand, but I'm not really sure I do. Oh, let me see if I can put in my own words what you're saying. That kind of being listened to. Paul Tournier has said how beautiful, how grand and liberating this experience is when people learn to help each other. It is impossible to overemphasize the immense need humans have to be really listened to. Listen to all the conversations of our world between nations as well as those between couples. They are, for the most part, dialogues of the deaf. God forgive us, and God teach us how to listen.
By the way, there is a little project in here that I didn't get to. It's on page 8, Communication Skills as a Listener. How good a listener are you? And you might want to go through this one. It's it's pretty penetrating. It could be embarrassing in a good sense. So you might want to do that. And this is something that you need to talk over together once you've filled in your answers. The other one, just the page before that, 7, Marital Intimacy Checklist. What you need to do is individually go through this and you evaluate as a husband, and then you separately as a wife evaluate where you feel the two of you are in your own marriage relationship in each one of these areas of intimacy. So it's from your perspective of how are you doing as a couple, each of you. Then after you have filled that out, sometime when you're going to be together for 2 or 3 hours, like we did this one day, we were taking a car trip, and we knew we were going to be driving all day, and we filled it out ahead of time, and then we started talking through each one. We started with communication, the spiritual commitment, and so forth. And we spent quite a bit of time on each one, just discussing, and we, on every one of them, we were looking at it from a different perspective. There was not one that we had the same evaluation of. And so, you know, that opens the door for a lot of talking and trying to get into the other person's mind and their perspective and what's going on and why is that. And of course, you may run into a little bit of conflict here. Conflict is probably inevitable. Combat, however, is optional. So, you know, keep it on an even keel and as objective as you possibly can. But then after we had finished going through all of these, we ask ourselves the question, well, okay, right now at this point in our lives, which of these is the one that we need to work on the most? And so we went back through and began to talk about it again, and what we agreed on was that 7 was the thing that right that at that point in our lives, this was several years ago, we needed to really work on recreational intimacy, because I've always loved athletics, always been involved in some way or another, and Carol has been a terrific spectator. And so we hardly had ever done anything recreationally together. that was just fun in some kind of a sport or activity. So we began to talk about, well, what would we like to do? And we talked about a number of things, ruled them out. Finally, we started talking about tennis. And Carol had never played tennis, but she'd always been kind of attracted to it. She liked to watch it on TV. And I'd played a little tennis when I was in high school. And so we thought, well, we'll give it a try. So when we got home, we got some rackets. We tried it a few times. We took some lessons. Finally, we joined a little tennis club that had indoor courts right near where we lived and really found that we enjoyed it. Now, Carol, if she were telling you this story, she would say there were two things that she had to pray about. One is, because she's not very athletic, she said, I'd have to pray that I would be good enough to enjoy it. Because if she didn't enjoy it, she wouldn't pursue it. Secondly, she'd have to be good enough to not embarrass both of us. Well, God answered both of those prayers. She really began to enjoy playing tennis. She got good. We could play a good game of mixed doubles with other couples. And that went on for several years. And we really had a lot of fun doing it together. Then I had an old knee injury reoccur, and it got worse and worse. Finally, I had to give up tennis. I just couldn't play anymore. And so we were still committed to recreational intimacy. So I asked her one day, I said, honey, would you be willing to try golf? Of course, I've played golf all my life, love it. Well, she wasn't sure. So she prayed the same two things, that she would enjoy it and that she would be good enough not to embarrass both of us. So I got her some clubs. We got her some lessons. She began to like it. Now she loves it. We played a week ago last Wednesday. She shot the best round of golf in her life. The first hole she birdied. First time she'd ever birdied a hole in her life. She got a 3 on a par 4. She, don't get too excited, huh? Just settle down. She shot 108 and she had a 47 on the front 9. She sunk 4 putts, all of which were over 30 feet. The first one, the birdie she got on the first hole, was from off the green. It's usually about 5 feet off the green. She putted it and it dropped it. I tell you, man, that was the beginning of some round of golf. So we have a great time playing golf together. And many times we're traveling, we'll take our clubs along and we'll have an opportunity to play it once or twice. So this might be something you want to try one of these days when you've got... It's not something you just sit down and do in 15 minutes. You've got to really devote some time to do it right. And then when you get all finished, you know, ask yourself, well, at this point in our lives, which one of these do we really need to kind of zero in on? And you may find a whole new area of your life that's unexplored yet. So give it a try. One of the things that makes communication so difficult is that we believe that, most of us believe that meanings are in words, when in reality meanings are in people, for the most part. We've been taught all of our lives, right from very kindergarten on up through our education system, that when you want to find out what a word means, you go to Webster's Dictionary. And, you know, for the most part, that's a pretty good idea. But when you're communicating with somebody else, and you're just talking, and you're both using words and phrases, the nuances of meanings of words are more likely found in the experience and background of the person who is using that word or phrase than it is in Webster's Dictionary. And this is true both ways. So really, most of the time in verbal communication, meanings are in people, not in words. And that's one of the things that makes communication so difficult. Dr. Eugene Nida, some of you probably have heard of him. He is a world-renowned expert in the whole area of communication. But let me give you a little bit of his credentials. He's been translation secretary for the American Bible Society and the director of translation programs for the United Bible Societies. He's a foremost linguist. He's worked in some 75 countries, producing texts in over 200 languages. Dr. Nida has written 22 books on translation, communication, anthropology, and missions. One of the outstanding authorities in communication in the world, both from the secular world and in the evangelical world. And here is what he says about this matter of communication. True in any language, no two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. No two people ever mean exactly the same thing by the same word. Now, most of us don't really believe that. But if we're going to be good communicators, if we're going to really get to what Carol described as the objective of communication, the meeting of meanings, then we better get a hold of this concept. And that's why she talked about this matter of feedback, well, if I understand what you're saying, let me try and put it in my own words, and then so it's repeated back. And then it gives her the opportunity to say, well, not quite. What I really mean is, and then she'll say it again in a different way. And I see. And then I'll say it. So oftentimes, we will go back and forth 3 or 4 or 5 times like that before we feel that the person who is trying to understand what we really mean has got it. Now, folks, that takes working at. Most of the time, I don't want to give a percentage, but I will. I would say 80 to 85% of the time, when we make the assumption that we understand what the other person means, we're wrong. Assumptions are usually wrong. That's why it's so important to press on this. Well, to really want to understand. Carol was talking about husbands listening. You know, most wives who have a rather reserved, quiet husband would be absolutely ecstatic if at some point in a conversation he would say to her, well, honey, I really want to understand what you're trying to say, but I don't. Help me. Wow, okay, man. You know, that it would open up a whole new realm in this whole area of communication. We've got to take it seriously if we really mean business in our marriage relationship, because communication touches every other aspect of our relationship. Every aspect of our relationship is touched by the communication patterns in our lives. Let me talk about just a couple of nevers. Our little warnings. We already talked about why questions and how devastating and dangerous they can be. But let me mention a couple of other things that are along similar lines. Never use sarcasm in kidding and joking with one another. Now, some of us have developed neat little patterns of humorous interaction that could be characterized as sarcasm. Sarcasm could be defined as humor at the expense of someone else. When it really gets down the road a little ways, when it becomes sophisticated. Don Rickles makes a living at sarcastic humor. Carol and I, when we were first married, the first 2 years of our married life, we did exactly that. We developed a little pattern of kidding with each other in a sarcastic way. And at first, probably in the first year, it was not doing any damage. We didn't mean it in any double meaning. It was just simply humor. And it came off okay. But then as time went by, we began to realize that this was a pretty good way of getting a little jab into the other person without them really knowing for sure whether it was just pure humor or whether there was a barb intended. And so we found ourselves beginning to do that once in a while, and we became very good at it. The next progressive step in the development of this sarcasm between the two of us was the "can you top this" thing. I would make a sarcastic statement. She felt the necessity to come back and top that one, and then I would come back and top that one. And sometimes we'd go back and forth three or four times on that. And at that point, it really began to hurt, and we realized it. But folks, it had become such a habit, we didn't know what to do about it. Then, at the end of that second year of marriage, that summer, I was going to seminary down in Dallas, Texas at the time, and I was invited to come to California, Pasadena, California, to be a youth pastor in a church for the summer. I accepted it. We kind of moved our stuff out to California and were there for about 2.5 months, and I had a wonderful time. And in the process of ministering in that church that summer, we got to know the pastor and his wife. Really a neat couple. Obviously had a great thing going in their own marriage relationship. And on numerous times during the course of the summer, we would be thrown together with them in all kinds of situations, ministry, social, etc. And one of our observations, the first part of the summer, was that even though they had a great time together, they kidded with each other, joked around, had a lot of fun, they never used sarcasm. So one night we were out to dinner with them, and we asked them about this. We told them that we had noticed that they really loved each other and that they had a great time and had a lot of fun. They kidded with each other, but you'd never use sarcasm. Tell us, how do you do that? I mean, it's a problem with us. Well, they virtually repeated our story back to us. The first couple of years they were married, they fell into this habit. It got worse and worse and worse, and finally they realized they were hurting each other. One night they sat down, they talked about it, and they committed, they made two commitments, one to each other and one to God, that they were going to stop it. And their commitment was so strong that they agreed that if they did it from that point on, they got down and they committed this to themselves, and then they committed it to God. They prayed over it, and the commitment was so strong that they said to each other, when we do it, we will call each other on it. Not in the presence of other people, but after the situation is over and they're headed home, just the two of them, or when they're by themselves, they would call each other on it. Boy, that takes overcoming a lot of pride to do that. Well, Carol and I listened to that, and we went home that night. We talked about it. We got down on our knees beside our bed, and we made that same commitment. We said, Lord, we want you to help us with this. We know it is not a positive aspect of our relationship. We want to get rid of sarcasm because it's hurting our relationship. And we committed to one another that we were going to stop it. It was hard because it was such a habit. We would do it and not even think about it. It probably took us the better part of 3 or 4 months to totally break the habit. Our problem is, like you, we're still human beings, and it still creeps out once in a while. I did it one time right at the close of a marriage seminar. I was saying something about Carol, and I made some sarcastic right in front of the whole bunch. But the minute it came out of we had sensitized ourselves to it so much that when we did it, we recognized it now. It wasn't unconscious. And so I had to apologize to Carol. I had to apologize to the whole bunch right in front of everybody because it was terrible. So we're humans. But for us, that has become a no-no. Maybe you can handle it, but it's something, if it is sort of a way of life with you, it may be more hurtful than you realize. It may be something you need to talk about, but it's part of the communication pattern. It can become. Another never that that we have agreed on quite a long time ago, and which we see violated all the time in people we're around, is never criticize or correct or interrupt him or her in public. Now, that's a tough one. I mean, I've stopped preaching now and started meddling, I realize. Never criticize, correct, or interrupt him or her in public. And here again, we're human, and it happens. We were having dinner with a couple the other night, and Carol said something, and I came back and corrected her. The minute I said it, I wanted to reach out and pull those words back. Doesn't happen very often, but after we got away from there, I had to apologize to her. The minute we got in the car, I said, "Honey, I am sorry." Totally unnecessary. It was a little dinky thing. So we need to be careful of that. Correcting. Criticizing. Interrupting. Boy, that's a big one in our society. Interrupting. We get with couples and, you know, one of them's trying to tell a story and the other one interrupts either the story or something else that has one word or phrase that the other person has used that triggers another thought and they go off on a completely different direction and have interrupted. And you never get back to what the other person was saying. And it was really interesting. There's a couple that we know here in town that happens with all the time, and we know them well enough that, you know, when he is saying something, he's telling a story, and she interrupts and goes off on a different tangent, I'll say, hey, now, wait a minute. I want to hear what Dean's got to say. And I can do that, and they, you know, they don't get mad at me because we're good friends with them. And, you know, we've tried to talk to them about it, but it is such a way of life with them, I don't think they'll ever overcome it. It's just, they're constantly interrupting each other. You know, when that happens and you're in the presence of it, how do you feel? Well, you're a little bit embarrassed, aren't you? Yeah. And, yeah. Correcting. You know, Carol's a writer, and I've learned a few things about writers, not only her, but other friends I have who are writers, and they tend to exaggerate a little bit. You know, they embellish. You know, it's not lying, it's just kind of, you know, putting some zing into it. I remember one time years ago we had a men's conference up in Wisconsin over Thanksgiving weekend. It was a terrific weekend. We had about 987 men there. And the Spirit of God really moved in and did some marvelous things from Thursday night through Sunday noon. And when I got home, I took more than 10 minutes to tell Carol all about this great conference that the men had up in Green Lake, Wisconsin. Well, a couple of weeks after that, I was eavesdropping on a conversation that she was having with some girlfriends of hers. And she was telling them all about this men's conference. And she was really elaborating on it, embellishing. There were just over 1,000 men there, you know. And I thought to myself, now, you know, 987, that isn't just over 1,000, that's just under 1,000. Now, what do you do in that kind of a situation? Keep your mouth shut. That's putting it about as bluntly as you can get. Well, I prefer to put it a little more subtly than that. I prefer to say I take the 20-year view. In other words, what I could do is butt in and say, now, ladies, if you really want to know the facts, there were 987 men there, which is just under 1,000. And there were several other things that she said along that same line. You know, just slight exaggerations. Because I asked myself the question, 20 years from now, will it really make any difference to those ladies whether it was just over 1,000 or just under 1,000? And the answer I always get back is, no, it won't make any difference 20 years from now. In fact, it won't make any difference 20 seconds from now. And usually it's a little rinky-dink thing. I mean, we hear couples correct each other on the most ridiculous things. I mean, he's telling the story and he says something about Alaska. Well, it really wasn't Alaska. It was New Zealand. But, I mean, what difference does it make whether it's Alaska or New Zealand? Pretty much the same. Oh, my. Now, I realize there are exceptions to this. And, you know, if something's going to be repeated wrong for the next 20 years, well, what we need to do is figure out a way to get off to by ourselves and get it worked out and get the facts straight. Now, you factual people. You know, you have a struggle with that, and we all do. And so, but you know, do it over a nice dinner with candlelight and all that sort of stuff. You know, make the atmosphere right for the correction process just between the two of you. Okay. Now, one other thing about this matter of communicating. What do you do about? Oh, by the way, this. Let me back up just a minute. This matter of correcting and criticizing and interrupting. I came across a little statement by Charlie Shedd in his book, Letters to Philip. That's sort of one of these things. You raise your right hand, you put your left hand on the Bible, and you say, I solemnly swear. And here is what you solemnly swear. Neither by day or by night will I ever cut you down in company. Not before my family, your family, our family. Not before friends, acquaintances, strangers. When you are with me or behind your back, never by wisecrack or snide remark or in any manner do I intend to be anything other than 100% loyal. You see, I am the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club. She's really terrific. She's a great gal. I love her very much. She's talented. She's gifted. And I am the president of her fan club. I know she's got fans all over the country, but I'm the president. Now, why is that? Well, there could be a number of reasons. You know, she is a wonderful wife. She is a faithful companion. She's great company. She's fun to be around. She's a tremendous cook. That has both pros and cons to it. She's been a wonderful mom to our daughter. She's terrific with our grandkids. She meets my needs. And all of those are good reasons, but they're not the reasons why I am the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club. The real reason that I am the president of the Carol Mayhall Fan Club is because I love her. And because I love her, I want her to look good in the eyes of other people. I don't want to run her down to other people. I don't want to criticize her. I don't want to interrupt her. Now, I say that motivated by all the right reasons, not wrong reasons. She's a great gal, and I love her. And therefore, I don't want to criticize her in front of other people. Because that makes her look bad. It makes me look bad also. So, give some thought to this matter of criticism and correction and interrupting. One more thing. What do you do about that little thing or those little things, there may be several, that your spouse does or the way they say something that just irritates you? You know, it's not a big mad you get on. It's just a little irritation. And every time they do it, it just kind of irks you. What do you do about those things? I mean, little things. I'm not talking about big deals. I'm talking about little things. For instance, we used to have a shower stall in a house that we lived in. It wasn't a big one. And rather than having one faucet that you adjusted for hot and cold, it had two faucets, one hot, one cold. And had a glass door on it that swung open. And every once in a while, I'd go in to take a shower shortly after Carol had been in there, and I'd reach in kind of blindly to get the faucets and turn adjust the water right before I got in there, because there wasn't room to get in it and adjust the water. You'd either freeze yourself or scald yourself. And oftentimes, I'd reach in there, and instead of getting hold of those nice, shiny, chrome faucets, I would get hold of a wet, cold, soggy, soapy washcloth that was draped over the faucets, which my loving wife had left there. Now, all of us know that that is not the proper place to hang a cold, soapy, wet washcloth. And it happened several times, and I was getting pretty irked about it, and I didn't know what to do about it. So One night we were out to dinner, and we were really having a great time. And so I thought, okay, now is the time to bring this up. So I did. And I did it in a very nice way, very soft pedaled, you know, not making a big deal out of it. And, you know, her response was, she didn't get mad. She said, well, honey, if it really bothers you, I can figure out something else. But she says, you know, there really isn't a towel bar that I could hang that washcloth on without walking all the way across the bathroom. Now, the bathroom wasn't that big, but, you know, in the nude and so forth. She said, could you get the towel bar and put it right outside the shower door? I mean, fantastic idea. So, yeah, I went down to a little store down the street and found just the right... I measured how much wall space we had there, and it would have to be a short one. I could only put about an 18-incher on there. And got one, put it up, and it solved the problem. But what did we have to do? We had to talk about it and compromise, right? We had to talk about it. Communication. Sometimes we let these little irritations, and usually they're little, build up and build up and build up until we blow up, and then we get historical. Huh? Yeah. And we talk about all these things, when in reality what we ought to do is take them on one at a time and deal with them and pick the right time and have the right attitude and discuss them. You'd think a nice guy like me would never do anything that would irritate his wife. I used to have the habit of taking off my pants at night before I went to bed. I still do. I still take off my pants before I go to bed. But I turn them upside down and put the cuffs together, and then we have a chest of drawers in our bedroom. It kind of sits over in the corner. It's out of the way, and it doesn't, you don't look at it all that much. It's clear over in the corner. And I would open the top drawer and put the cuffs in, close the drawer. It's the neatest pants hanger you've ever seen. And sometimes I would get two or three pairs of pants hanging in there. And finally one day, Carol brought that up. Now, I knew before that she was a little irritated by it. There were some attitudes that showed just a little bit once in a while, and I would see her once in a while. See, one of the problems was that drawer was hers. She had her stuff in that drawer. But, you know, I didn't figure that out. I mean, community property, all that sort of stuff. And I'd see her sometimes trying to get something out of that drawer when I had a couple of pair of pants hanging in there. And I realized it was sort of difficult. But, you know, I kind of shrugged it off. That was her problem. But finally she brought it up. And we had to talk about it. And she explained to me the way of life more fully, in a nice way, and that the proper place for pants was in what we call the clothes garage, normally called a closet. That at night, you put the car in the garage at night. Well, you put your clothes in the clothes garage at night. And she was real nice about it. And I had to agree with her that was probably the right thing to do. But bless her heart, she went out to a store and bought me several pants hangers. There's little wire things. They're neat. They got rubber things on the end. And you just press it here and it opens up. You put the pants in. You squeeze it here. It clamps on the pants and you put it on the rod. And, it solved our problem. But we had to talk about it. It was a little irritation to her. And these things happen all the time in our married life. How are you resolving them? Communication is the key. We've got to talk about them. Huh? We've got to talk about them. Well, I don't have time to do what I was going to do. So, we'll let you out about 6 minutes early and have a nice lunch. Have a good afternoon. It looks like a gorgeous day out there. So enjoy Colorado.